Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Everybody, this is Richard Martin here from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you live from Miami, Florida, through the studios of Progressive Radio Network in New York City. Well, as most of you probably know, this is my last live broadcast before I leave the United States, and so I intend to make it as informative as I can, but I thought I would, at the same time, give you some of my personal views on what I think is behind the current meltdown, the obvious depression in which we're living right now. First of all, I think it needs to be said that there is a very clearly defined economic cycle, and I don't think that anything can upset that cycle. There are certain things, even to do with us human beings, that are more powerful than we ourselves. And cycles are one of those things. Cycles exist in every area of our lives. They exist as day turns to night, as you know, the seasons follow each other. And I think that people like to think, as much as they possibly are able to believe that they can influence events, that cycles don't apply to them. And for example, in the financial markets, there is clearly a down cycle in progress, but the forces of the establishment are going out of their way to do everything they can to try to prevent the natural play out of these cycles. And it's so utterly fruitless. It's pointless. I mean, if we transcend all the issues of who's to blame for this and that and who's responsible for things, it's really quite clear that in the end, we're just humans on the planet. And there are forces, frankly, which are stronger than ourselves. You know, the tides come in and out. Women have their own menstrual cycle. You can't alter the state of affairs such as they are in a macro concept. And one day, of course, the cycle will turn and start, things will look up again. But things will be different. I think what one has to try to understand at this point is not that there are or aren't cycles, but that when America finally emerges from this current depression, it won't be the same country. It won't have the same dynamism attached as was the case in 1945 after the Second World War. It will be a downgraded, very modest and beaten down country, I think. Not that there is anything unusual about this. I mean, I don't say that America will be any different from other countries that have suffered in the past, but America has always assumed itself to be in a kind of state of exceptionalism, where America would prevail just by virtue of being America, and this very dangerous and toxic idea that America is the greatest country on earth, and we are, you know, the chosen people, and people are lucky to be able to come to live here. All these perceived virtues are actually not just wrong, but they're dangerous, because they force people into a mindset that I don't think that they will easily relinquish as things get better. And right now, the person talking to you is a person in the form of myself who has, to a large extent, seen it all before. I mean, I am just old enough or young enough, you know, to remember the end of the British Empire. And I suppose that I was the unwilling recipient of a country and its attitudes that prevailed after the empire had been disbanded or was in the process of being disbanded. And I remember there's a story I always like to tell about when I was 7 or 8 years old in school, and I went to my geography class, and we were all handed a fresh copy of what was called the Phillips Modern School Atlas, a large green, blue document. In fact, it was I suppose it was a book, but it was more in the form of a document with maps and pictures of the whole world. And in the front page was a general view of the entire globe, and all the British Empire bits were red. Somewhat like in this country where it really should be blue, but, you know, Britain did things differently, didn't they? Like Americans, really, when you have the blue states and the red states really should be the Democratic ones, and the blue ones should, by rights, be the Republican ones if you take international colors seriously in terms of right and left. But, well, we had the same thing. We had the red countries were the British Empire. And there was only one small problem. The empire had ceased to exist. But they hadn't yet come out with a new edition of the Phillips Modern School Atlas. And what this meant was that we were learning the wrong geography, and we didn't even know it. And I don't remember my teachers telling me, look, I'm sorry, but this isn't right. This is actually wrong. This is not what it's supposed to be. That these countries shouldn't all be red. Some of them still should, but others really should have reverted to green, blue, or brown, or whatever it was. But they never did. The teachers couldn't even bring themselves to admit in the geography class of a 7 or an 8 year old that these red countries really shouldn't be red anymore, that the empire was dead. Now, I don't have any particular input into this situation. I feel sorry for the teachers. They were clearly smarting under the blow of losing an empire. I don't know what I'd have done in their place. You know, I feel that they should probably have come out and just said, you know, this is not the right map for today. But again, when you're dealing with a 7 or 8 year old, how are you going to explain the political intricacies of a globe which is no longer what it seemed, you know? But mainly, I think what the lesson to be drawn from this is that America, like Britain, is going to be very humbled in the next few years. And the people are not going to take this well. There will be resistance, there will be anger, there will be irritation within families themselves, as actually was the case with my family. I mean, my parents, even my older sisters, who are much older than me, came from a different generation. They came from a generation where, you know, the prevailing thinking was if you were British and you went out into the world, you had to hold your head up straight, you had to behave correctly because you were British, and everybody looked up to the British. Patently, by the time it came round to me, this was a ridiculous concept. I mean, there wasn't any British Empire to stand up for, and these kind of old-fashioned ideas were just surreal for somebody in my situation 10 years later from the episode that I just described. I fear that the same kind of disparity of thought will come to exist in America. I do think that Americans will have tensions and squabbles and fights within families and other social settings between older people who remember how people admired America and looked up to America. and the new generation who have realized that America is really just a jumble of old debts that they can't get rid of, that are strung around their neck, bad reputation through injudicious foreign policies, a military which is basically in the wrong place at the wrong time, in fact being asked to leave as often as not and having to come home with its tail between its legs. This is the sort of thing that will greet the young American of the future. And it will be tough. Life will be very tough. I think there are parallels in the past. And certainly, you know, I hope that the people who are responsible for the ultimate meltdown here, among them and leading them, you know, at the head of the crowd, being, of course, Alan Greenspan, there is no one more guilty than he of causing this terrible meltdown that we're seeing in front of us. But other people in history have always received what I think is an unfairly warm glow in their reputation. Chief among them, I think, being Abraham Lincoln, who is, for some reason that I've never understood, held up as a kind of hero in American history. And the idea that he was the grand liberator is really so far off the mark that it really hurts. I mean, I had found this particular instance of the fourth debate of Lincoln with Stephen Douglas in 1858, where Lincoln declared, and I quote, "I will say that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races from living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they could not so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." I mean, anybody who's not heard this before presumably will be very shocked. But they really shouldn't be, you know. These views are in fact evident throughout Lincoln's political career. For example, when he was serving in the Illinois legislature, Lincoln never challenged the anti-black legislation of his state. He voted against black suffrage and refused to sign a petition allowing black testimony in court. Lincoln was also a strong supporter of colonizing freed blacks, convinced that they could never be assimilated into American society. So take that as a warning, that when you go back and you listen, you know, to the ravings of people in favor of certain political figures, notably among them, I think, Ronald Reagan, it may be that, that there is another side to the story. Let's look at a few things which I think have contributed in a rather more oblique fashion to the current grim situation in which we find ourselves today. You know, looking at, for example, California, thanks to its relatively high welfare payments, it attracts a large number of people who want to collect welfare, and this has resulted in serious and persistent economic difficulties for the state for years and years. And to cope with the strain, California adopted a policy in which new settlers, for the first year of their residence in California, were limited in the welfare benefits they could receive to what they would have had in their state of origin. So, of course, it went to court. And in a case known as Science versus Roe in 1999, the Supreme Court found, surprise, surprise, that California's law violated the 14th Amendment. And this time it was the Privileges or Immunities Clause that was cited. California, by limiting the amount of welfare money it paid out to settlers in the first year, apparently violated the right to travel. And by forcing California to increase its welfare payments to new residents, the court had, in effect, raised taxes on Californians without their consent. I have the impression there was a revolution fought over that somewhere. Well, what you have now, of course, in California is a situation which is totally out of control. And from any day now, California is going to default, in my opinion. It's already starting to issue IOUs in payment for services rendered because it simply doesn't have the cash. So it's useful to see somewhere, you know, where how these things actually do originate. But most principally, I think, in terms of where this country has gone wrong, and I mentioned this on Monday, it started out as a virulently capitalist state, which really worked. It did work. I mean, basically, there were tweakings to be done to the system, always, of course. But basically, when you had a new country with new people without the vested traditions of the past, you could take a bunch of oligarchs, and they could work for the general good. And in particular, I would refer to Henry Ford, who actually raised his workers' salaries and wages, saying that the more money they made, the more Ford cars they would be likely to buy for themselves and their families. So there was a benign element to the concept of capitalism. And I think you have to sign on to this because basically you're Americans, and Americans believe in capitalism. And so you can't say in one breath, oh, I believe in capitalism, but I think there shouldn't be this, or there should be that, or we should do this or that. You either believe it or you don't. And I think there was a time when it was believable, and then that time just disappeared. And I think what made it disappear was simply the growth of the population, where it no longer became practical to apply the principles of capitalism to a nation such as the United States. And I'll give you an example of where it, you know, really worked. In the days where mergers and acquisitions could lead to powerful and efficient monopolies, Standard Oil, which is today sort of typically excoriated and condemned in junior high and high school textbooks, was in fact an excellent example of American ingenuity and efficiency. And it actually provided considerable benefits to the great mass of consumers. And until the 1850s, crude oil had been nothing but a nuisance to farmers who found it seeping from their soil. But when Yale University chemist Benjamin Silliman discovered in 1855 that it could be refined into kerosene, a better and potentially less expensive illuminant than the whale oil then in widespread use, the only question was whether it could ever be collected in sufficient quantities to make it marketable. When Silliman silenced skeptics by drilling for oil in 1859, this useless substance suddenly took on tremendous value. So what happened at that point? Who did what to bring this to the maximum use and benefit of Americans? Well, John D. Rockefeller appeared. He had managed to work his way up from stock boy to partner in a Cleveland store. In 1859, when he was 20 years old, oil had been discovered in northwestern Pennsylvania, not far from Cleveland. Rockefeller was intrigued at the possibilities of oil, but looked beyond the obvious venture of acquiring an oil well or two. He was convinced that the refinery business held out enormous opportunities. In 1862, he bought into a partnership in a Cleveland refinery. He was committed to streamlining production and eliminating waste. This paid off for him and for consumers. He managed to reduce the price of kerosene, which was $1 per gallon when he began selling it, to a mere 10 cents by the 1880s. He was troubled by the disposal of the waste product that remained after the oil was refined, and he eventually produced 300 products out of the waste. Thanks to Rockefeller's efficiency and low prices, millions of Americans who had previously gone to bed early to save money could now afford to illuminate their homes. So what happened to prices? Well, they declined throughout the period of Standard Oil's dominance. When the Russians struck some of the world's most oil-rich lands in 1882, they were poised to eclipse American oil production. So in order to compete, Rockefeller would have to cut costs further. He did. Well, of course, needless to say, when you have somebody in that situation who is successful, antitrust comes along. Now, I'm not at this point going to give you, a sort of lowdown on the benefits of antitrust or the disadvantages or even, a moralized version of whether it's good or bad. But you have to really understand that by the mid-20th century, the arbitrary character of antitrust law had become apparent to at least a small segment of the public. It destroyed Pan-American by preventing it from acquiring domestic routes, thus depriving it of so-called feeder traffic for its international flights. IBM was harassed for 13 years because it had 65% of the market. By the time the government finally gave up on the case, the company had already been eclipsed by its competitors. And then even as early as 1937, General Motors actually made it company policy for the next two decades not to gain more than 45% of the automobile market out of fear of antitrust prosecution. Some experts say that this self-imposed restriction partly explains why Americans lost so much market share to the Germans and Japanese in the latter half of the century. Now, again, I'm not going to go into the whys and wherefores or the advantages and disadvantages of antitrust, just to show you piecemeal what effect it really did have. Coming to the political side, and I mentioned this before, but I think it bears repeating. Warren Harding is generally considered to be one of America's worst presidents. But both he and Calvin Coolidge usually wind up near the bottom in presidential rankings in the estimation of historians. And this is no surprise. I mean, these presidents engaged in no large-scale social engineering. They embarked on no vast legislative program like the New Deal or the Great Society. And they involved the United States in no major foreign war. And frankly, since most historians favor an activist government committed to what they call social justice at home and abroad, they have little sympathy for chief executives who simply leave the American people alone. And yet, America prospered during the 1920s. American business set production records. Wages increased. Working hours declined. And as if to underscore yet again the irrelevance of labor unionism, these outcomes occurred at a time when labor union membership was undergoing a rapid decline. No, Harding and Coolidge didn't establish a square deal, a new deal, a new frontier, a great society, or a new covenant. For the most part, they simply stayed out of the economy and out of people's lives. But the results speak for themselves. By the end of the decade, the United States could boast an incredible 34% of total world production, followed by Britain and Germany, each with just over 10%. No wonder historians loathe Harding and Coolidge. These presidents' success go to show how much better off the country might be if ambitious politicians with their grandiose plans would just shut up and leave them alone. Most people believe that Hoover stood by and did nothing as the Depression ravaged the country, and that it was Franklin Roosevelt's vigorous intervention into the economy that finally brought recovery. Nothing could be further from the truth. First of all, it's not true that Hoover sat idly by during the Depression. He did plenty, more than any peacetime president had ever done. Rexford Tugwell, an important figure in FDR's New Deal programs, later acknowledged, and I quote, We didn't admit it at the time, but practically the whole New Deal was extrapolated from programs that Hoover started. In fact, Hoover's incessant meddling with the economy made the situation worse. He managed to turn the recession in 1929 into the Great Depression. While the economic picture was poor in 1929 and 30, it was only in 1931, after a year of government intervention, that the situation seriously deteriorated. Well, then you had the notorious Smoot-Hawley tariff, which was originally intended to provide tariff protection for American agriculture, but it turns out that there was no politically feasible way to limit that protection to one sector of the economy. Pressure groups from countless industries descended upon Washington to argue for tariff protection. Virtually all American economists united in urging Hoover to veto Smoot-Hawley, but Hoover ignored them all and signed it into law in June 1930. It raised tariffs an average of 59% on more than 25,000 items. The tariff hit American export industries hard. America's trading partners inevitably retaliated when their products were shut out of U.S. markets. For instance, the Italian government responded by doubling its tariff on American cars, whereupon American automobile sales in Italy fell by 90%. The French practically shut American products out of their country altogether. Spain retaliated by raising tariffs on American cars to a level that practically guaranteed that no American cars would be sold there. You know, the result was the disastrous Revenue Act of 1932. It was the largest peacetime tax increase in United States history up to that point. Income tax rates were increased dramatically, and surtaxes on the highest income soared from 25 to 63%. This meant that in the middle of the Depression, when private investment was desperately needed, it was made much less attractive. Hoover also vastly increased spending on public works projects. More money was spent on such projects in 4 years than in the previous 30. So then FDR comes to town. Well, in 1932, Roosevelt defeated Hoover in a landslide. Along with Washington and Lincoln, FDR is routinely listed in polls as among the great presidents. Many Americans believe his New Deal programs rescued the country from the grips of the Depression. In fact, under FDR, unemployment averaged a whopping 18% from 1933 to 1940. One biographer said that there was no one more ignorant of economics than FDR. It showed. FDR knew nothing about how wealth was created. The legislation he called for was a patchwork of absurdities, sometimes at odds with each other, and sometimes even at odds with themselves. The National Industrial Recovery Act, which was established as the National Recovery Administration, was an enormous contradiction. On the one hand, it sought to keep wage rates high to give the consumer greater purchasing power. On the other hand, it established hundreds of legally sanctioned industry-wide cartels that were allowed to establish standard wages, hours of operation, and minimum prices. The minimum prices meant that businesses would be largely prevented from underselling each other. Everyone's price had to be at least the prescribed minimum. The artificially high wages meant continuing unemployment, and the high prices meant hardship for nearly all Americans. Some strategy for recovery. FDR's agricultural policies were in a class of genius all of their own. Not content with setting high prices for other goods, FDR moved on to food. He proposed to pay farmers for cutting back on production or producing nothing at all. The decrease in supply, he believed, would raise farm prices. But in the meantime, he had to deal with the existing bounty. The administration decided to destroy much of what had already been produced to create a shortage and thereby raise farm prices. 6 million pigs were slaughtered, and 10 million acres of cotton were destroyed. FDR's legacy in agriculture continues to be felt today. In the 1980s, the USDA ordered the annual destruction of 50 million lemons, 100 million pounds of raisins and 1 billion, that's a billion with a B, oranges. Indeed, for most of the 20th century, the price of sugar to Americans was 500% higher than the world price, thanks to government price supports. This is certainly a boon to sugar producers, who receive an average of $235,000 a year from the policy. But it costs consumers well over $3 billion a year, and it puts all American industries that use sugar at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis foreign producers, who are not forced to pay such an inflated price for sugar. And now we're coming to yet another example of the famous public works project that Obama is ready to throw upon us. The New Deal's admirers assure us that FDR's massive spending projects provided jobs and economic stimulus. But such jobs are funded by taking money from some people, taxpayers, and giving it to others. So there is no net stimulus. In fact, such programs are positively bad in that they divert capital from the private sector and inhibit healthy job creation. If you're building a bridge, what are you going to do when the bridge is built? You've got to go out and look for another job. Economists John Joseph Wallace and Daniel K. Benjamin found that the public sector jobs created by New Deal spending programs either simply displaced or actually destroyed private sector jobs. The various public works programs that FDR established and the billions of dollars that he devoted to them only dried up capital in favor of government projects that were inherently wasteful, since they lack the kind of profit and loss test that guides entrepreneurs in their investment decisions. Well, the Supreme Court waded in and became an instrument for justifying federal action and for reducing the states to a condition of subordination. In a case known as Curran versus Wallace in 1939, the court suggested that the federal government could extend its power over virtually any area that might continue to what they called the general welfare. It has become part of the conventional wisdom that World War II was a time of great economic prosperity in the United States, and even that the war rescued the country from the Depression. This is simply not true. If it were, then it might be a good idea to be at war all the time. Think of all the people we'd put to work producing raw materials, building planes, and assembling missiles. Historians have made much of the substantial production figures that were attained during the war, but most of this increase was due to the construction of armaments and military equipment and payments to military personnel. This production was not geared towards things that ordinary people needed. It made consumers worse off by diverting capital and other resources to goods that no consumer would want to buy. Between 1943 and 1945, some two-fifths of the labor force, including the armed forces, civilian employees of the armed forces, people who worked in the military supply industries, and the unemployed, was producing neither consumer goods nor capital goods. That was not all, of course. The tax monies of the remaining 60% went to fund the activities of the 40% that were not producing things consumers needed. All of this amounted to a dramatic loss of material wealth. So, moving along to the 1980s, where a private accounting firm performed an audit of the Job Corps, it discovered that a mere 12% of people leaving Job Corps programs found work in the field for which they had been trained. For that matter, only 44% found any job at all. The average hourly wage of that 44% was $5.09. That is what a program spending $21,333 per client has to show for itself. The classic study of 1960s social policy, which practically defined the terms of welfare reform in the 1990s, was Charles Murray's Losing Ground. That book advanced the provocative thesis that the Great Society programs, as well as increased AFDC, that's Aid to Families with Dependent Children, availability, were themselves largely to blame for the stagnation of the poor. These programs, in short, were not only expensive, they were also counterproductive. The Economist reported in 1988 that less than 1% of America's poor was composed of couples who finished high school, got married, and stayed married, and kept a job, even a minimum wage job, for a year. The incentives introduced during the 1960s made it less and less likely that people would consider it worthwhile to follow these basic steps, namely marriage and a steady job that had meant escape from poverty for so many. People who are interested should pay particular attention to Chapter 12 of Losing Ground, where at great length Murray details the case of a typical couple in 1960 and in 1970. He shows how the incentives at work in 1960 would have led them to marry and led the husband to enter the job market, but that the incentives in 1970, in which countless types of welfare benefits were available in abundance, worked against marriage. AFDC benefits were taken away if the woman married, and encouraged the husband to enter the job market only intermittently, if at all. The resulting family instability, and the fact that modest economic security was, thanks to the government, now available outside marriage, led to an explosion in out-of-wedlock births, and with it all the pathologies that social scientists have found among children born outside two-parent households. Poorer academic performance, much greater propensity to crime, drug addiction, and the like. 60s liberalism also sent the wrong incentives regarding crime and education. For a variety of reasons, in the 1960s, a criminal's chance of both being caught and of going to prison if caught declined significantly. During the 1960s, the absolute number of people in federal prisons dropped, despite a doubling of crime during those years. On top of that, increasingly liberal laws regarding juvenile crime made a life of crime practically costless for a young person. In Cook County, which includes Chicago, researchers found that by the mid-1970s, the average first-time reform school student had already been arrested an incredible 13.6 times. And since more and more states were making juvenile crime records practically inaccessible to employers and others, with some states actually destroying juvenile crime records when a delinquent turned 18, there seemed to be little practical reason for young people not to break the law. Also, during the 1960s, the federal courts sharply restricted schools' ability to discipline, suspend, or expel disruptive students. More wonderful contributions to American life, courtesy of the American Civil Liberties Union. The result was increasingly unmanageable school populations and more difficulty imparting education to those youngsters who did want to learn. Teachers who insisted on standards of excellence found themselves threatened, assaulted, or otherwise made miserable. As time went on, the best teachers and the best students simply left, with the result that the school was now even less manageable than before. At that point, the usual suspects in politics and the media would begin their drearily predictable demands for more money for the school in question, even though the inner city schools were already spending well over $12,000 annually per student by the 1990s. Again from Murray, and I quote, "All the changes in the incentives pointed in the same direction. It was easier to get along without a job. It was easier for a man to have a baby without being responsible for it, for a woman to have a baby without having a husband. It was easier to get away with crime. Because it was easier for others to get away with crime, it was easy to obtain drugs. Because it was easier to get away with crime, it was easier to support a drug habit. Because it was easier to get along without a job, it was easier to ignore education. Because it was easier to get along without a job, it was easier to walk away from a job and thereby accumulate a record as an unreliable employee. The dramatic expansion in welfare spending, along with the aggressive propagation of the welfare rights philosophy, undermined what Murray calls status rewards. The working poor family, which had once been the dignity of knowing that they were supporting themselves and not being a burden on their usually poor neighbors, now seemed simply foolish." And again, quoting Murray, "Once these highly functional sources of status are removed, the vaunted work ethic becomes highly vulnerable. The notion that there is an intrinsic good in working, even if one doesn't have to, may have impressive philosophical credentials, but on its face, it's not very plausible, at least not to a young person whose values are still being formed. To someone who is not yet persuaded of the satisfaction of making one's own way, there is something laughable about a person who doggedly keeps working at a lousy job for no tangible reason at all. And when working no longer provides either income or status, the last reason for working has truly vanished. The man who keeps working is, in fact, a chump. End of quote. Well, the Johnson administration even gave federal money to spend propagandizing and organizing the poor to demand what they were told was rightfully theirs. And of course, in so doing, they undermined the working poor's self-image. If there was nothing undesirable or shameful about receiving welfare, then conversely, there was nothing particularly admirable about working and avoiding welfare. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, you know, this is a lot of this is probably very contentious to some and very new to others. But I will tell you that the underpinnings of today's society have been in jeopardy and undermined given a bad name for decades. This is nothing new. This is what we have seen since the 1990s, when America finished with their policing the Cold War and set itself into a process of making itself richer by printing more paper and giving more apparent wealth to people, which set themselves up for a calamity in 2005, 2006. This situation was a result of a despondency with the status quo, with an inability to keep on track the kind of values which gave people the ability to work and the desire to work, fully in the knowledge that at the very least their money was worth something. You know, this all goes back to the Federal Reserve and the fact that since the introduction of the Federal Reserve, the dollar has lost 97% of its value. Well, clearly, if the same money, which by the way has not progressed in real terms since the 1960s, was buying fewer and fewer products and services as the dollar became more and more valueless, then obviously a woman was brought in to work, a woman who up until that time is perfectly content being at home looking after her family, and then encouraged to believe that this was her right, which of course it is. Nobody's disputing that. But the values, the fundamental values which kept America as a prosperous and forward-looking country were consistently undermined. And again, I'm not giving any value to this. I mean, there will be people who said, who will tell me that this was a good thing, that people were liberated, that all sorts of other, you know, things happened. But basically, that's not the point here. The point is a discussion of the reality of the situation such as it has been. A simple statement of what happened, of one situational milestone followed by another and another and another, leading to where we are today. Because where we are today has no reason to exist. We don't have the need to be living in a country which is hobbled and on its back, as America patently is. And that's what's very sad from my perspective, is that not necessarily that we are in a situation that we're in. Because as I told you at the beginning, there is a cyclical nature to all things, including the economy. What is very sad is that people are kept from an understanding of why that is. They are kept from being allowed to admit and accept that the values which had brought America to the state that it was were consistently undermined and led, you know, to a kind of general free for all where the concept of thrift just went out of the window and people go in and just take money that they don't have to buy things they don't need, courtesy, of course, of the Federal Reserve. And so now we're in a situation where something has to happen because these values clearly don't work. So are we going to stay with them? Are we going to give them another name and try to give value to the values? Or are we simply going to say at one point, this doesn't work? We simply have gone down the wrong path. And I don't think that the second alternative is going to happen. And that's why I do think that people will have to be brought back to those values in a very unpleasant way. I think it involves social unrest. I think people are going to have to be shown in a very unpleasant, a very aggressive form of economic destiny that they are going to have to change their ways, they're going to have to change their ideas about things, and all of the apparatus of the 1990s and the 2000s are going to have to be disbanded. Right now they're not being disbanded, they're being added to. There is no understanding, even today, with housing prices down as much as 50-60% in some areas. There's still no understanding and no desire to understand. The same talking heads appear on television. The same writers, these liberal writers like Thomas Friedman are still writing stuff. The same economists, you know, with their head-in-the-air theories like Paul Krugman are still mouthing off the same inanities. The same government employees are still doing the same nonsense that they were doing. Like, for example, Obama, as part of his stimulus package, is planning to throw billions of dollars at the American school system. We know from past experience that the only thing that this will stimulate is contractors' accounts and teachers' salaries. You know, America is spending more per student in real terms than it has ever done, and the result is as bad as it's ever been. No, Obama should move to raise standards, but he can't because of the fractured state-by-state tradition of education. And you know, in other countries this doesn't happen. In other countries they take the bull by the horns, they standardize education, they make sure that the teachers are properly versed in the kind of education that a state should be seen meting out to its students, and the students are expected to conform to the standards set by the state. Well, of course, here that's considered out-and-out socialism. Although why a particular educational authority in, southern North Dakota should be any more qualified to decide what's in the best interest of the students than a national board of educators gathered in Washington is quite beyond me. But they don't think like that, because in this country it is considered that all problems can be solved with money. And so Obama is proposing money. And quite frankly, without getting involved in politics, as you know I don't, I must tell you that I think Obama is the most disappointing president that I have had any connection with, either personally or in a historical context, according to what I've read. He's not a bad person. He's not a person who is out to sabotage people's lives, but he has simply not come through. And I think that's very sad, and I think that it is also very alarming. I think that many people will have a hard time coming to terms with that in the years to come. I must tell you that I haven't much time to talk about many other things right now, but I do think that it is very, very alarming that in the job market, which after all stimulates the economy here, there has been no growth in jobs for almost 10 years. People don't know this, of course. You're going to be told that the recession has put jobs in jeopardy and everything, but jobs have consistently been rising by 1.1% over the last 10 years. And that, by the way, is the lowest 10-year increase in the post-depression period. Over the past 10 years, the private sector has generated roughly 1.1 million additional jobs, or about 100,000 a year. in stark contrast to the public sector, which created about 2.4 million jobs. But even that gives the private sector too much credit. Remember that the private sector includes healthcare, social assistance, and education, all of which are areas which receive a lot of government support. Now again, ladies and gentlemen, where do you want to live? Do you want to live in a country which is basically run by the government, which is run by the public sector, where the much vaunted private industry, private enterprise, small business sector is simply eased out by big government projects funded by you, the taxpayer? Is that where you want to live? If that's the case, you'd better make sure that your government people know their jobs and they know what they're doing, because there isn't much sign that that is the case. If you don't want to live like that, then you will have to move, because there's no question in society that when governments gain power, they keep it. They never relinquish it. There is not a case of anywhere in the world where governments which have had power relinquish that power to the private sector. Even in the case of Russia today, who eliminated the communist system, have maintained a hold over the people in Russia today. And it's a very scary thought, and I haven't got time to go into it today, but in all areas of Russian life, you will find that most ordinary people haven't noticed any difference between the way things were under the communists and the way they are today. And I'm not talking about the economic function. I'm talking about the general relationship between authority and the people. The sectors which have gained jobs in this country, the top three sectors, were private healthcare, food, and government education. Well, it's interesting that the private healthcare should be one of the top elements of growth in the job sector, because of course the private healthcare is given the nod and assent by the very government that controls it and lets it go about its everyday business almost like an arm of the government. And were it to be an arm of the government, of course it wouldn't exhibit the same tendencies as it shows today. Anyway, listen, I have to take a call from Frank right now, which I will do. Let's hear from him. Frank, hi, how are you?
Hi, Richard. I'm doing well. I just wanted to say thank you very much for all that you've done and to wish you bon voyage.
And thank you.
I'm looking forward to hearing you real time again when you get settled in Singapore.
Well, I look forward to talking to you, Frank. I'm sure that we shall meet again, as it were, over the waves. I have no idea how it will work. I haven't got my IT chips in place yet, so that will have to come first. There may be some teething problems that will have to be sorted out. But you will have shows until, I think I'm right in saying, let me just look at my list here. I think my last show that I've recorded is for the 20th of August. So I'm not sure if I will need to stay away that long, but at least you're amply covered from my absence. I think you'll enjoy some of the shows. Some of you will appreciate some more than others. They take on a little more of a surreal quality because, you know, I really didn't feel that I was talking to an audience when I did them. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning as often as not. And may I take this opportunity of thanking Ryan, tried and trusted engineer, for being unfailingly at his turret every occasion on which we did these things, and I'm very, very grateful to him for taking the time to allow me to record all these myriad of shows, which basically last almost a whole day. I think if it's 19 shows, it's 19 hours. I'm not sure what it is, but it's a lot of shows. And, I tried to select items of general interest. Obviously, you're not going to get the updated version of the economy and what's going on. That will have to wait. But as I did say to you, if there is anything that is very pressing that needs to be discussed, I will actually break in and ask Ryan for a live show at that point. I can do this, you know, from hotel rooms and bars and probably, you know, restaurants if necessary. But I'll talk to you if I have to. Thank you. I appreciate that, Frank. Daryl from the Bronx is back. We haven't heard from you for a while, Daryl. How are you doing?
Richard, how are you?
No, not too bad at all. Thank you.
If you're happy, I'm happy that you're getting to go to Singapore. I've been listening to a lot of Bloomberg lately, so there's a lot of action going on out there in Asia. However, I'd just like to bring up that, you know, in the United States of America, although there's little evidence of it, the government is constituted by the people. And if we as the population fail to take responsibility for what the people in Washington are doing, which we have not done for about a long period of time, then what comes out of that situation resembles some of the things that you're talking about. However, since I'm 60 years old, person of African descent in this country, when government is discussed, it's not the government that has been in power over, I would say, the last 12 years that has allowed corporations, especially the rating agencies, to go pretty much on their way and make obscene profits. What needs to happen is that the population needs to, rather than separate themselves from the government, exert their strength and govern themselves.
Yes, I would agree with that. The only thing that I would disagree with profoundly, Daryl, in what you said, was what you said at the very beginning. I don't think the people vote for their government. I actually don't. I think they do. But, I mean, when you take someone like Barack Obama, who seemed particularly out of the loop when it came to, you know, politics. The guy had been, you know, a teacher of constitutional law at a university. He'd done work with the inner city, the good work with inner city affairs in Chicago. He seemed particularly unmindful of the traps and lures that were about to await him when he joined the White House. I don't think he has any control or say over what happens. I mean, how can he? He doesn't know anything about economics. He can't possibly decide who's going to take the reins of the economy. He doesn't know enough. He has to rely in 100% on the people who are already in place. So under those circumstances, I don't think it's possible to assume that Americans really, practically and realistically, have a control over the government that they like to think that they do. But this is not necessarily a criticism. I mean, you know, in some countries like France, if you're in the government, you take exams, you study politics, much like an airline pilot has to study aeronautics, and you can't just fly a plane without knowing anything about the sky, and you can't run a government without knowing anything about government. And that's what I think is sad, is that there's this kind of empirical, take it or leave it approach, which definitely comes from Great Britain. I mean, this is an inheritance from the British way of doing things, the empirical idea. We do it by trial and error, and we'll see what sticks type thing. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I am afraid it is the end of another final version of the Richard Martin Wage Cup Call, and I thought I would just like to end with a little poem from Daryl Robert Schoon, or Schoon, I don't know how to pronounce his name, I probably should. And it goes like this. You can feel it in the air, there's a stirring everywhere. An end is coming soon, an end to this cocoon. An end to all we know, an end to what's been so. An end to funny money, an end that's not so funny. I wonder what will be, what tomorrow we shall see. And may the grace that brought us here transform our every fear. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I will be back soon. Have a wonderful summer. Bye-bye.